Section 2, Black Responses to Segregation. As you read, look for the segregation faced by Black North Carolinians, the growth of Black neighborhoods, differences in education between whites and blacks, and the following terms, paradox and shotgun house. Progress put severe limits on North Carolina's black citizens in the early 1900s. Even the few black residents who had money and lived well still had to nod their heads to most whites, even the poor ones. An African American walking down a street was expected to make way for any white person. As one white resident of Durham described it, no matter how successful a black citizen became, he or she still had to be like a servant to any white. In the years after 1900, North Carolinians developed segregated neighborhoods. After Reconstruction, blacks had lived in small clusters throughout towns like Charlotte or Winston. Over time, however, black communities were put off to themselves, often separated from white streets by the railroad tracks that split the towns. This was the case in Rocky Mount in the east and Hickory in the west. As Charlotte grew during the early part of the century, so did the level to which it was segregated. Until the 1890s, black businessmen like Dr. J.T. Williams kept their shops downtown next to white stores. Then, facing threats and opposition to their presence, they began to move to the western side of town. There they developed neighborhoods like Biddleville around Biddle University, today's Johnson C. Smith University. Most of the residents of Brooklyn, another Charlotte neighborhood, had to go back to the white areas of town for work. They generally performed unskilled, lowly, jobs like shoveling coal, running errands for a white shopkeeper, or taking in laundry or cooking for white families. Blacks struggled to get a piece of progress. The best-known attempt was made by Warren C. Coleman, a Concord merchant. In the 1890s, Coleman convinced the Duke family to help him build a cotton mill in his hometown. He wanted to prove that whites were wrong to say that blacks were not good industrial workers. The Coleman Mill opened right after 1900 and was operated for a few years by hard-working African Americans. The factory, however, closed when Coleman died. Black neighborhoods. Although Durham practiced segregation just like other North Carolina towns, there were more opportunities there for black residents to achieve their individual bests. In 1900, Durham was home to 5 millionaires who had made their fortunes in tobacco. Unlike the textile industry, which only gave marginal jobs to black men, the tobacco manufacturers hired blacks. This meant that Durham blacks had incomes higher than the state average. Most importantly, Julian S. Carr, son of Bull Durham Tobacco's owner, built a sock factory in 1904 and, despite being threatened by his fellow whites, hired blacks. Those wages built the most envied black neighborhood in the state. Durham's Black Wall Street. Hayti, pronounced Hayti by its residents, was located south of the cigarette factories along the railroad in Durham. Business was so good that the black section of Durham soon gained influence over the rest of the state and became famous across the nation. In 1907, the Mechanics and Farmers Bank opened and soon had more deposits than any other black bank in Charlotte or Greensboro. More importantly, in 1911, the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company erected its headquarters next to the bank. What Durham residents came to call the Mutual had been founded in 1898 by John Merrick and several partners. Merrick had been born a slave near Clinton in Sampson County. After Reconstruction, he became a barber in Durham. His customers included the Dukes and the Carrs, who encouraged him to start a burial fund company. One of the biggest expenses of poor families was to pay for a loved one's burial. Mutuals provided a way to do this by asking for a nickel or dime a month on a policy that would pay the expenses. Such insurance companies were also in Charlotte, Atlanta, Nashville, and other southern cities, but Merrick and his partners soon grew theirs into the biggest black-owned business in the region. The Mutual aided blacks across the state. Particularly in eastern North Carolina, the Mutual agent was a black school teacher or preacher who earned a little cash handling insurance accounts, thus helping the entire black neighborhood. Stores, churches, and businesses of all types grew up around the bank and insurance building. One visitor called Haiti the Black Wall Street because it had become such a center of business. Nearby, prosperous black families built houses that rivaled those of white families on main streets across the state. A Haiti resident, one visitor noted, could wake up on a mattress made by blacks, live in a house constructed by black labor, buy clothes in a black-owned store, and spend the day in the company of other successful blacks. He could send his children to the new black-run North Carolina College, started in 1910 by the Reverend James Shepherd. If sick, he could be treated by black doctors, like Dr. Aaron M. Moore, at a hospital started in 1916. A prominent black leader from the North observed, "Durham has distinctly encouraged the best type of black man by active aid and passive tolerance. This is surely progress." Haiti, like everything else progressive, had its paradoxes, situations where initial appearances are misleading to people. More than 600 residents owned their own houses and lots, but all the policemen were white. Shotgun houses. The homes and neighborhoods of most black North Carolinians did not resemble Haiti. As the black population grew, both white and black businessmen rented them shotgun houses instead of the old log cabins of slavery. These houses could be found in rural stretches of Harnett County or the streets of the town of Wilson. The narrow end of the house faced the street so that more houses could be built on the block. They went back two or three rooms with no hallway and their doors always lined up. This feature gained them their nickname because if all the doors were open at one time, a shotgun blast would go through the house without touching anything. These houses had the barest of comforts. When North Carolina towns obtained paving, electricity, running water, and sewers in the early 1900s, the white neighborhoods were redone first. Few blacks had any modern amenities. Most had to pump water from a shared well and use the outhouse at the back of the lot. There was no insulation, and it was rare for a landlord to provide window screens. Limited schooling. Despite the best intentions of progressives like Governor Aycock, black education lagged behind white education in the early part of the 1900s. During the Aycock era, one black school was built for every 10 white schools. In towns, brick was increasingly used for white schools. Black schools were built of wood and often left unpainted. Although graded schools were part of the new century, most whites assumed that black children needed only a minimum education. Rarely did black children have ready access to a high school during the period. Blacks were expected to continue to do work in the fields throughout the East and to do service jobs in the manufacturing areas of the West. Schooling, then, was tailored to the task assigned by progress. In the early 1900s, blacks often turned to Northerners for help building their own schools. In particular, Julius Rosenwald set up a fund after 1914 to build black schools across the state. Rosenwald was one of the owners of Sears Roebuck, the mail order catalog company in Chicago. In most counties, the wooden Rosenwald School became the best facility available to black students. Some black teachers gained a foothold to teach wherever they could. Charlotte Hawkins Brown had grown up near Henderson. Her family moved to Massachusetts, where she was educated. She returned to Sedalia, a hamlet, small village, near Greensboro, to teach in 1901 in an industrial training school. When the school was closed for lack of money, she converted an old blacksmith shop into a classroom. She also broadened the curriculum to give her students a true education, not just one that would prepare them to take the lowest skilled jobs. In 1902, Brown received new funding to open Palmer Memorial Institute in Sedalia, which focused on a complete education through high school for young blacks. By 1912, Brown had become a leader among African-American women in the state.